This is a Defocus Media production.
Hey, everybody. I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session.
And now a word from our sponsors. Did you know that 77% of eyeglass wearers wipe their lenses with t-shirts, tissues, or towels? Or that 1 in 3 people actually admit to accidentally dropping their glasses at least once a week? No one in the eye care industry needs to be told that this will lead to scratches on lenses and unhappy patients. So it's hardly surprising that 93% of wearers consider scratch resistance an important characteristic when choosing lenses. The latest Crizal lens innovation is here to help, and it's more durable than ever before. New Crizal Rock lenses are 3 times more scratch resistant than entry-level Crizal products and 2 times easier to clean than main competitors after extensive smudging. For more information about how you can bring this incredible new technology to your practice, go to EssilorPro.com/Crizal-Rock or contact your Essilor account executive for more details.
Thanks for joining me today on the first episode in this series. And we're going to be talking about a topic that, quite frankly, is a bit uncomfortable to talk about. And it's about medical errors, malpractice litigation, and how just due to bad luck an unforeseen event can really wrap its ugly arms through us in a very negative way and affect our livelihood and our personal life for, quite honestly, a long, unfortunate time. So again, my name is Chris Levens. I am an optometrist and a professor, as you just heard. And in terms of law, we used to have a law class about optometric issues in the law, the one I taught for many years, and I've been an expert witness in a number of cases. I've had depositions taken. I've actually been in court and taken the stand, and I'm going to give you some perspective on a lot of these issues moving through this entire series. But it's appropriate to start at the beginning and really kind of frame the context of this challenging situation so that hopefully, with a little luck, but more importantly, with a little different approach to thinking about patient care in our practice, we can do what we can to prevent some risks. So I like to title this content overall, Practicing Eyes Wide Open. And so let me explain that for a moment. I'm not going to encourage anyone to practice defensively. So assuming that unforeseen issues are going to face us and might pose some risks to us, but rather just being aware of what we do, why we do it, and how we do it in a way that you visualize what you're doing from above or from an external position rather than your firsthand approach, to really do things smartly and not accidentally. Do them with your eyes wide open. So first off, should you really be concerned about this? The chances of you being sued for malpractice are slim, so maybe you ought not to be worried. Well, not necessarily the case. Even though you're competent, you're conscientious, and you care about your patients, we all take continuing education courses, and we keep those up to date to maintain our licensure. You may run an incredibly efficient practice and provide very high eye care for your patients of a very top-notch quality. But despite all those things, we still live and practice in a litigious society. And so you may do it all right and still find yourself in dire straits. And so take a step back for a moment and really look at this from an entirely different perspective, because your knee-jerk reaction might be, this would never happen to me. I don't really need to be worried about this. So frame it like this. What are your minimum expectations of your own doctor when you are the patient? So let's come up with a hypothetical. Let's say you're having a very bad weekend this month, and today, beginning of the week, in the middle of your busy patient care day, you start experiencing heart palpitations. And you realize, whoa, I never felt my heart beating like this before. It feels like it's going to jump out of my chest. There's a problem here. And so maybe you schedule an appointment with your primary care doc, or maybe better yet, you schedule an appointment with a cardiologist that you've never met before. All right, so you're nervous about a health condition that may be bad, and you go visit a doctor's office for the very first time. What are your minimum expectations of that visit? Think about that for a moment. What's the minimum thing you expect to get out of it? Honestly, there's a lot of nice to haves, but not a lot of need to haves. Minimum, I mean, it'd be nice if it was a very nicely decorated office with very friendly staff and the place looked clean and smelled nice, but that's not the minimum expectation. It'd be a nice to have if your doctor was friendly and courteous. But again, that's a nice to have, not a need to have. Your minimum need out of this visit is for the doctor to tell you what's wrong and what comes next. Do they have to run some tests? Do they have to give you some medicine? But the minimum expectation is they tell you what's going on and they take care of it. They get it right. All right. Pause. Herein lies the problems. You and me, we're human. We're going to make mistakes. We cannot live up to our patient's minimum expectation that we get it right for them 100% of the time, that we get the diagnosis correct and the treatment appropriate and get them on their way. We make errors. We make medical errors because we're human. We have bad days too. And so the major crux of this whole entire issue with regards to malpractice is we're human, yet our patient's minimum expectation is we get it all right on them. And when we don't, okay, then there's an issue. And one of the most common issues in optometric malpractice is the whole category of misdiagnosis. And in later episodes, we'll talk about other pitfalls and areas of concern, but misdiagnosis is a big one. And it really can reside in two camps. You can either miss a disease or condition entirely. You know, you have a poor BIO, the patient wasn't dilated particularly well, and you just miss it. So you miss it entirely. Conversely, the camp two is you call it the wrong thing. In other words, you see something and you know it's not supposed to be there, but you misdiagnose it by misnaming it and potentially use an entirely different treatment than is most wholly appropriate for the correct diagnosis. So I'm going to give you a little bit of good news today on this episode, because a lot of what we're going to be talking about in future episodes on this topic are disheartening at times. Now think, though, I'm going to give you some strategies to try to work through these negative issues, but today I'm going to give you some good news. And that is, if you have a patient who becomes a plaintiff with their plaintiff's attorney in a malpractice case, there are actually four hoops that the plaintiff side must jump through to even get the case to fruition. And so we'll talk about that, because if any one of these four falls flat, well, slam dunk, done deal, they'll move on to the next person and the next complaint. But there are four hoops. Probably one of the biggest ones that deserves some time and attention is called standard of the reasonable person. And if this was a live lecture or interaction roundtable, I'd boldface, underline, italicize, make in bigger print the word reasonable. And that is the conduct of the one being charged is compared to the conduct of a reasonably prudent doctor with the same skill and experience. Again, reasonable is the key phrase here. If you find yourself in malpractice trouble or just a complaint at the front end, because we're talking about the initial hoops here, you're not being compared to the best optometrist in the land. You're not being compared to the best ophthalmologist in the land. You're just compared to the reasonably prudent doctor who, in the exact same circumstances, what would they do? Obviously, these circumstances are hypothetical, but if they were placed in your shoes, what would they do? And the term that we used is the standard of care. That's what the standard of the reasonable person means. It's the standard of care. So where do you find that? Well, if you get on Amazon right now and search the optometric standard of care, you're going to get no hits. There's no book. There are no tables. There are no charts. If you open up the AOA clinical practice guidelines, they use very ambiguous language. So if you do actually open that up and start to read some of the verbiage in there, you'll see sentences like this. So in the book that discusses how often you should dilate patients, one of the categories in which you would dilate more frequently is a patient who's at higher risk. So for example, one with very high levels of myopia. And so if you read the text on that, it says something along the lines of, dilate those who have high myopia frequently and regularly. And that's it. It doesn't say what exact the date is. Is it every 6 months? Is it every 12 months? Is it every 24 months? It also doesn't define what is high myopia. Is that minus 6? Is it minus 8? 12? Okay, it doesn't say. And so it leaves it up to interpretation, but honestly, that's purposeful. And it's not like these authors were dropping the ball. They just know that in legalese, if you put something in print that is highly specific, then you're going to be held to it. If it said, for example, hypothetically, that for patients who have 8 diopters of myopia or greater, you must dilate them every year. Well, then, if you happen to see a patient who's 8.25 myope and you see them in 366 days, you just failed to meet a leading optometric association's guidance on your own professional care. And so they purposefully make these ambiguous so that we're not specifically held to them and we can still use our own clinical judgment. So we're going to spend time on a future episode about how the standard of care is defined. But very quickly, as a teaser of what we'll talk about later, is it's all decided through expert witness. The plaintiff will have to find an expert that says what you did not meet what the prudent doctor would typically do, did not meet the standard of care. And it'll be up to your defense team to find an expert that says you did meet that standard of care. But the good news here is it's all about the reasonable person, not the best or leading person. So another tidbit here, who's going to decide this stuff? Who are we going to be able to call as an expert witness? Well, in eye care, it's actually varied. Back in 1959, the case Sims versus Callahan decided that it had to be one within the same profession. Problem is, 11 years later, and this is all medical malpractice, in 1970, Harris versus Bales case allowed an osteopath to testify on the actions of an MD. Well, 7 years later, in Fairchild versus Bryan, a MD was allowed to give testimony to establish an optometric standard of care. And then 10 years later, in 2007, with Bates versus Gilbert, an ophthalmologist was disallowed to offer testimony in optometric care. So the ball has bounced around. In my experience, it's likely to be both. You will likely to have an optometrist trying to establish standard of care for and against you, and you may also have an ophthalmologist, but you typically will have an optometrist in all the cases I've been involved in. And we will dive much more in depth into what an expert means, does, and how to establish those later. All right, so the first hoop is standard of the reasonable person. Well, hoop two, very common sense, is you didn't do that. At least that's what the plaintiff has to show. The plaintiff side has to show that, yes, number one, they're established, that a standard of care has been established and can be defined and described. And number two, you failed to meet that. You failed to meet what the reasonably prudent doctor would have done in your same setting, in your same shoes. Hoop number three, my common lingo for this one is, well, you just have to connect the dots. And the dots being, there has to be some link between what you did or did not do appropriately and the damage to the patient. It can't just be some random coincidence that you failed to do something perfectly in exam and the patient went on to suffer something, but it's random, not linked to you. So number three, they have to connect the dots. And number four, and I just mentioned it, there's got to be an injury. The patient has to have suffered something. Now, this is very loosely defined because it can be a physical ocular injury. However, it can also be a temporary injury. It can be a peddling injury. It can be hidden. So you go all the way from the minor things to the severe, disabling, evident things and the whole gambit in between. So that's it. In order for the case to come to fruition, the plaintiff patient and the plaintiff's attorney side must jump through these four hoops. Identify standard of care. Show that what you did failed to meet that standard, proximate cause, that we can link the dots that specifically show what went wrong and link it back to what you did or didn't do. And number four, there has to be some form of injury. Once that's shown, they're off to the races. And that's why we're going to have some more chats about this in episodes to come. But have a wonderful day, and thank you for joining me.
Class has ended for today, and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.